be seated. Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome students who are joining us for this oral argument, Lakeland Union High School students. Would you please stand? Oh, my gosh. Thank you for coming. We're delighted to have you. You may be seated. This morning we had Loyal Middle School students, Port Washington High School students, and now Lakeland Union High School students. And they are here with a national award-winning program entitled Court with Class. And it is a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite students across the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, the students receive materials about the case that we are about to hear. They may do some extra activities relating to the judicial system or the case. They come to court, and at noon, or thereabouts, the students meet with a justice assigned for the day to meet with the students. I keep saying students, but everyone is always invited to attend those sessions. The session related to the procedures used by the court to take cases, decide cases, and issue opinions. The discussion was not about any substantive issues about the cases. If the council had wanted to attend, I'm sorry if I'm telling them this late, but you can come next month, and we do the same thing, so you can participate if you wish. Does anyone here want a summary of the case? If not, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser was the justice assigned today to meet with the students. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To his left is Justice Patience Robinsack. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With these introductions made, I'll call our last case for today and scheduled March argument. And it's 13 AP 2013 AP 1753 CR and 2013 AP 1754 CR, State versus Guarnero. Arguing for the defendant, Mr. Guarnero, is attorney Robert J. Eddington. He will have 25 minutes. It will be followed by Sarah Larson, assistant attorney general, who will argue for 30 minutes. That's maximum time, not required time. And 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Eddington. Counsel, you may proceed.
Counselor, before you begin, the podium raises and you're fairly tall, so you might want to put it up. Should be a button.
There we go.
There you go. Good.
Thank you. Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Robert Eddington, and I represent the defendant, appellant, petitioner, Rogelio Guarnero, in this case. Your Honors, the central issue on appeal today is whether Guarnero's prior racketeering conspiracy conviction arose under a statute relating to controlled substances within the meaning of Section 96141(3)(gc) of the Wisconsin statutes. It did not, Your Honors, and I would like to focus my argument today on three main points. First, that unlike a substantive racketeering conviction, a racketeering conspiracy conviction never contains controlled substances as a statutory element of the offense. Second, that the modified categorical approach cannot be applied in this case because the statutory elements of racketeering conspiracy are categorically broader than those of a generic drug offense. And then third, that reversal in this case is necessary to prevent confusion in the lower courts about how, if, or when a so-called modified categorical approach could be applied, as well as to prevent the likelihood of Sixth Amendment Apprendi violations stemming from the improper use of that doctrine. Turning to the first point, Your Honors, this case must be decided on the statutory elements, and indeed only the statutory elements, of racketeering conspiracy. We urge this court to hold that a statute cannot relate to controlled substances within the meaning of Section 96141 unless that statute contains controlled substances as an element. Under the U.S. Supreme Court's holding in DeCamps versus the United States, as well as Richardson versus the United States, statutory elements are those facts that must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt and on which a jury must unanimously agree. Restricting a sentencing court's focus to elements is critical in this case because when Guarnero pleaded guilty to conspiracy, he was only admitting the statutory elements of that case and nothing more. In DeCamps, the U.S. Supreme Court took great care to clarify that whatever a defendant might say or might not say about facts that do not constitute statutory elements cannot be used by a later sentencing court to impose extra punishment. In this case, Guarnero was convicted of racketeering conspiracy under 18 U.S.C. Section 1962D, which was a part of the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, also known as RICO. There are only three statutory elements that need to be proven to sustain a conspiracy conviction under this statute. First, that the defendant knowingly conspired to conduct or participate in the conduct of the affairs of an organization through a pattern of racketeering activity. Second, that the organization was an enterprise. And third, that the defendant's activities would affect interstate commerce. The term racketeering activity is itself defined in another statute, Section 1961, and can include dozens of state and federal offenses. Some of those offenses are drug offenses. Some of those offenses are not. But importantly, under the Supreme Court's ruling in Salinas versus United States, those so-called predicate offenses that are contained within the definition of racketeering activity are not themselves statutory elements of a conspiracy conviction. And what that means for this case is that Guarnero could be charged and convicted, and in fact was charged and convicted, without any proof that he himself committed as a controlled substances violation or in fact that anybody committed any particular offense or any particular controlled substances crime. Not only did the Supreme Court in Salinas hold that, but also the Seventh Circuit in a case called United States versus Teo that we cite in our brief, which was an appeal that arose out of the very case that Guarnero was convicted of here. In that case, the Seventh Circuit also confirmed that in a conspiracy conviction under 1962D, there is no requirement that the government prove the commission of any predicate act, or indeed that anybody has committed, let alone that the defendant had committed any predicate act, or certainly for purposes of this case, any controlled substance crime. Therefore, we contend, Your Honors, that it was a fundamental and indeed reversible error of the Court of Appeals below not to analyze the elements of racketeering conspiracy under 1962D.
Counselor, what if he had been convicted of his current offense, and prior to that he was convicted as party to the crime of violating the same statute?
Well, if it were party to the crime case, Your Honor, the rule that we're urging here is that the court would go back and look at the statutory elements required to sustain a party to the crime conviction. And as I understand that statute under Wisconsin law, there is a requirement under this court's case law that a jury would have to unanimously find that the defendant was involved in and participated in that underlying substantive offense. So under the rule that we're urging here, if when we look at that party to the crime statute, if controlled substances is one of the statutory elements, then that would satisfy the relationship that's required under 96141. But we contend that that's a very different type of conspiracy statute that we have at issue here. The Supreme Court in Salinas went to some lengths to contrast the racketeering conspiracy statute, which itself contains no overt act requirement, for example. Contrasted that statute with other federal general conspiracy statutes. And we would contend that that's the same analysis that would apply if the prior conviction were a Wisconsin party to a crime conspiracy type case. It would be a focus on the elements of that offense.
Counsel, doesn't the RICO statute apply to a controlled substance? When you look at subsection A and D, both of them seem to relate to a controlled substance.
Well, the statute, we would contend that the question of whether a statute can be applied in a set of factual circumstances is a different question than whether that statute relates to controlled substances. And in support of that, we would submit that any time that a trial court is looking at what that prior statute relates to, it necessarily is going to have to analyze statutory elements. If, for example, the prior statute were a gambling statute, for instance, the reason the trial court knows that that gambling statute does not relate to controlled substances isn't that it can't ever be applied in circumstances where controlled substances were at issue, but because that statute has no element, no statutory element.
This may not be very sophisticated on my part, so push back, but this is the way, at least arguably, it appears on the paper, and that is that you have the statute that we are referring to. You have the definition of racketeering, and the definition of racketeering in sub A and sub D, both you find the term controlled substances. So it seems to me not much of a leap to say that racketeering relates, the RICO statute relates to controlled substance.
Well, I think that this gets into the distinction that we argued and that the Court of Appeals didn't get into about the difference between what would be a substantive offense and what would be a conspiracy offense. If we had a substantive case, then you'd be exactly right in that we could look at the indictment, for example. A substantive offense would have to allege, and a jury would have to find beyond a reasonable doubt, that a RICO defendant had committed at least two specific acts of racketeering activity. So we would have to look at that definition, and we could see it from the indictment, because it would have to be charged that defendant committed, for example, gambling and arson, or whatever the two predicates are. In this case, because it's a conspiracy case and because there's no requirement that that be charged, alleged, or certainly proven beyond a reasonable doubt, we contend that's the difference. And even though in a conspiracy conviction there may be an allegation out there, there may be some proof that comes up at trial, for example, that controlled substances or gambling or whatever the other offenses might have been was somehow part of the case, because it's not a statutory element and because a jury wouldn't have to agree unanimously beyond a reasonable doubt that that specific offense had been committed, then we contend that that is a very fundamental difference and distinction. And again, it brings us back to another problem with the Court of Appeals analysis, which is a Sixth Amendment Apprendi problem. And in Apprendi, which was then later revisited in DeCamps much more recently, the court held that a trial court cannot make a disputed finding about facts that do not constitute a statutory element as a basis to increase punishment in a later case. The general rule under Apprendi is that any fact other than the fact of a prior conviction must be submitted to a jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, that wouldn't apply to a plea, though, because that's what we're looking at here.
That's right. It wouldn't apply, the jury part of it certainly wouldn't apply to a plea.
Right.
But what the, in DeCamps was a plea case, and DeCamps extended that rule and said, in the context of a plea, when there's an admission, that admission is limited for legal purposes, as a matter of law, is limited to an admission of those key facts that are statutory elements. Because in that case, there was a dispute under a California burglary statute as to whether or not the defendant, DeCamps, had impliedly admitted that his offense entailed an unlawful entry into a building. And that was not an element. That wasn't a statutory element under the California burglary statute. And the Supreme Court said, since it's not an element, it was an error for the court to use that fact that was not an element to increase punishment in a later case. And it's the primary reason for that was very soundly grounded in the Sixth Amendment and concerns with Apprendi. And we contend that that is the type of violation that happened in this case. If we look at the Court of Appeals decision below, the Court of Appeals went beyond merely identifying the fact that there had been a prior conviction, but it actually concluded, and this is in paragraph 11 of the Court of Appeals decision, it concluded that Guarnero himself had trafficked in controlled substances. The state also is making a similar argument at numerous places in its brief, including on page 16 of its brief, by suggesting that Guarnero pled that he, that Guarnero, agreed to commit distribution of controlled substances. That's not what count two alleges, and it's certainly not what Guarnero admitted, because anything having to do with controlled substances, none of that is a statutory element. And so under Apprendi and under DeCamps, that would not be an appropriate basis.
Go ahead, Pat.
Okay, I was just going to ask you this. Under DeCamps, it's my understanding that the court got into this modified categorical approach, looked at divisible statutes, and specifically talked about potential offense elements. Now, isn't that what you have here? Isn't DeCamps a lot broader than you're painting it for us?
Well, I think DeCamps, at issue in DeCamps was this question, it was an indivisible statute there. That was a case where a statute much like the RICO statute here, the conspiracy statute, was not a divisible statute, but instead an indivisible statute that just defined the offense very broadly. And key to the holding in DeCamps is when you have a divisible statute, a broadly worded indivisible statute where the government, the state, does not have to prove the specific elements of what it termed the generic subsequent offense, that when that's the case, then that prior conviction cannot serve as a predicate. And in fact, the modified categorical approach cannot ever be applied in that case.
Well, what's the significance of talking about potential offense elements then?
Well, our understanding and our reading of DeCamps is, again, that this entire discussion of whether it's strict or modified, the approach, that the focus of the court has to be, the trial court has to be the elements of that prior statute. So that is, and in fact, when the Supreme Court describes the methodology that is to be used, in fact, the only methodology that's allowed to be used under this approach, the first step is look at the elements. The trial court has to look at those elements of the offense and compare those elements of the prior offense to the elements of the later subsequent offense and make a determination there as to whether the elements of the prior offense are the same as or narrower than the elements of the later offense. And the court has held, I think, very clearly that if the elements of the prior offense, so in this case, racketeering conspiracy, are broader, as they almost certainly have to be in this case, then not only does modified categorical approach have no role to play in the case, that prior statute cannot serve, for Apprendi reasons, cannot serve as the basis for enhancement of a later sentence.
Counselor, we're just really interpreting a Wisconsin statute here. That's what we're interpreting. And why can't we just interpret it using our usual canons of statutory construction and determine that a statute relating to is a statute that has anything to do with controlled substances and not get into the test set out by the U.S. Supreme Court and relied on by the Court of Appeals?
Well, I think that we would agree that this court could certainly reach a decision in this case based only on the Wisconsin statute. In fact, that's how the case was argued at the Court of Appeals level. It was the Court of Appeals that adopted onto its decision, grafted into Wisconsin law, this fairly doctrinally complex idea of whether a particular approach is the strict categorical approach or the modified categorical approach. We think that and we would urge, in fact, that this court does adopt the rule that says that a statute relates to controlled substances. Our urging is only if it contains an element of controlled substances, not, and we would phrase it a little bit differently, Your Honor, because we think that it's our position that if the rule is, if it has anything to do with, that will almost certainly result in Apprendi violations, because it would be easy to conceive of a statute like, for example, gambling, having something to do with controlled substances if the offense as charged were that the particular defendant was gambling in order to support a drug addiction. That would be something that could be applied in a context where controlled substances had something to do.
So you're urging that the nexus has to be a nexus with the elements of the other statute earlier violated.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But what we're trying to determine is what was the legislature trying to do with this statute? They may or may not have been looking at the elements of the statute that was violated previously. They may look at it much more generically than that.
Well, in our research, in our briefing of this case, we didn't find any specific discussion in the legislative history of what the term relating to means.
Yeah. Well, so then we just apply the common and ordinary meaning. We could look in a dictionary, see what the dictionary says, right?
That is one of the canons of statutory construction. Another canon of statutory construction is to interpret a statute in a way that avoids constitutional infirmities. And it would be our position that an interpretation that was so broad that relating to can pick up any time that a statute could be applied in any circumstance having anything, literally anything to do with controlled substances, would raise some serious Sixth Amendment Apprendi concerns. Those were the types of concerns that animated DeCamp and Taylor and the string of U.S. Supreme Court cases. And even if this court doesn't get into modified categorical approach versus strict categorical approach, those courts' discussion of the Sixth Amendment, that was at the core of the approach that the courts took in those cases.
It strikes me that, to get back to your argument on categorical and non-categorical, that this is, and this was mentioned earlier in oral argument, if it's a party to crime under Wisconsin, then all the elements of the crime have to be proved, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Absolutely. You also have to prove conspiracy, but you have to prove all the elements. But if you charge someone with a conspiracy, that's 939.31, you don't have to prove that all the elements were ultimately in the case, right?
That's our understanding as well. But one of the things that would have to be proven under, it's 939.31 for conspiracy, would be that the defendant specifically intended the commission of the crime. And in a future case, if, for example, the charge had been conspiracy, for example, to distribute controlled substances, mm-hmm. if that were the prior, then if the element is that the defendant specifically intended that a controlled substances crime would be committed, then under our test, there could be an argument that there is a connection, a specific nexus.
So under your test, you'd get it both under 93905, too, which is the conspiracy party, and under 939.31, the way conspiracy is defined in our statute. And then I assume it's your position conspiracy is under the racketeer is not defined in the same way.
That's exactly our argument, Your Honor. And in fact, the Supreme Court in Salinas went to some lengths to make that very point. There are a number of, in the federal context, there are a number of racketeering, there are a number of conspiracy statutes. Racketeering conspiracy is arguably one of, if not the broadest one. There's also a general federal conspiracy statute that reads similarly to the Wisconsin statute. And the Supreme Court in Salinas took great care to point out that the racketeering conspiracy statute, because there's no overt act requirement, there's no specific intent requirement in it, that there is no element that would need to be proven with respect to a controlled substances or indeed any other predicate act.
Counsel, in the plea agreement, in the federal case, United States of America versus your client, 05CR240, it outlines the charges, it outlines the code provisions, it outlines the elements at paragraph 9, right? Your client entered into that plea pursuant to that plea agreement, right?
That's correct.
And the first element of that offense is that he knowingly conspired to conduct or participate in the conduct of the affairs of the Milwaukee Latin Kings and enterprise through a pattern of racketeering activity as described in count 2. So the description in count 2 is part of the first element. Are you with me so far?
I am with you so far, Your Honor.
Okay. Then when I turn to attachment A and it outlines count 2, because I was previously looking at the indictment, but the indictment's missing a number of pages, so I then went to this document. Count 2 talks about the allegations, that is specifically the grand jury's charges, and outlines the paragraphs, and then without reading every bit of it, it includes at various times relevant here to the defendants named in count 2, that's your client, right? And that's the part of what your client pled to, right? And others known and unknown were members and associates of the Latin Kings, a criminal organization whose members and associates engaged in acts of violence, including murder, attempted murder, robbery, extortion, distribution of controlled substances, in which operated principally on the south side of Milwaukee. And then it continues on and talks about, you know, they did this for the purpose of achieving the objectives in the enterprise. And they talk about the dates, and there's a significant period of time, specifically outlines a number of people, including your client, and then talks about how that affected interstate commerce, then goes further to say these are multiple acts involving the distribution of controlled substances, including cocaine, cocaine base in the form of crack cocaine, and marijuana in violation of Title 21, et cetera. Then it proceeds on. So what part of count one that specifically incorporates what I just read isn't a drug-related offense?
The question isn't whether it's a drug-related offense, Your Honor. With respect, our position is whether or not that is an element. And Salinas makes clear that it is not. So regardless.
The first element, paragraph 9, says it's the pattern of racketeering activity as described in count 2. I mean, you can't conspire. If you and I have a discussion and we're conspiring to go get a cup of coffee at Starbucks, that's not going to be charged as a crime. But if you and I are conspiring to engage in murder, drug activity, distribution of cocaine, crack, the crime isn't having a cup of coffee because we thought, oh, gosh, it'd be really great to go have one after this oral argument. We're conspiring to do that. That's not the crime. The crime is the murder, the drugs, all that. So you're losing me on this. You need to give me your best pitch on how that isn't part of what he pled to.
Okay, and I see that my time has expired. May I answer your question, please?
You may.
Thank you. Our best and strongest argument is that a jury in this case, if this had gone to a jury would not have to unanimously agree that Guarnero committed any particular predicate act because it's not a statutory element. And under DeCamps, which again is based on the Apprendi and the Sixth Amendment, Under those cases, a court is prohibited from making that determination about whether or not Guarnero committed or didn't commit or had anything to do with controlled substances. The focus is the element, and in this case, the element is not controlled substances. The element is, was there a conspiracy to conduct the affairs of an organization through a pattern of racketeering activity, and it doesn't matter.
But what your client pled to was what I just read.
Right. And again, under DeCamps, if it's not an element, it doesn't matter if he's pleaded guilty to something that may be construed later in time by a court to have some relationship to controlled substances, because that was not an element of the offense. And DeCamps is very clear that when there's a plea and there's an admission, these were also the facts of DeCamps, because there was an argument later on, in that case 30 years after the prior offense, about whether or not his plea and what he said in the plea agreement and the plea colloquy constituted an admission of that underlying offense. And the Supreme Court in DeCamps said it doesn't matter because it's not an element. So if it's not an element under DeCamps, even if he had specifically said in that plea agreement, I committed a controlled substance offense, which of course he didn't say, but even if he had said that, that's not enough under DeCamps.
What are the elements here?
The elements for racketeering conspiracy are, first, that the defendant knowingly conspired to conduct or participate in the conduct of the affairs of an organization through a pattern of racketeering activity.
Okay, so we have intentional conspiracy. All right. We've got affairs of...
Of an organization.
The organization, okay.
Through a pattern of racketeering activity.
Okay, what's racketeering activity mean?
Racketeering activity is defined in another a very long statute that sets forth, by our account, somewhere around 75 to 80 offenses.
Okay.
And the key element under that first prong is pattern of racketeering activity. So what has to be proven is that there were at least two. It could be gambling, arson, prostitution, and murder. It could be any of those. It could be controlled substances in a certain case, but again, in this case, we have in count two of the indictment, the way it's alleged, there are 49 defendants, and it could have been any of the 49 defendants committing the controlled substance or the murder or the whatever the underlying predicate is, and that, for our purposes here, we contend, is irrelevant because it is not an element of the offense.
It's not an element. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Sarah Larson, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
I like that lower, Counselor. You can lower it down. You don't need to keep it where it's not comfortable.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Lynn Larson, and I represent the state in this appeal. Your Honors, I would like to start my oral argument by directing you to the federal judgment of conviction, and that is the appellant's appendix, page 165. In the process of preparing for oral argument, I read more closely the federal judgment of conviction. And if you look under the title and section, USC 1962D, that is the conspiracy section, and 841B1C1. Reading that, you would think that would be 18 USC 84B1C. There is no 18841B1C. That is a Scrivener's error. The section that it really is 21 USC 841B1C. This is supported by the plea agreement in count two, appendix 163 or 139. When Gennaro is talking about, well, I'm sorry, when the count two is talking about the conspiracy, part of the acts, multiple acts involving the distribution of controlled substances, including cocaine, in violation of Title 21 U.S.C. Section 841. So we know that the Scribner's error, and we know that they're talking about 21 U.S.C. 841b1c. And this is the reason why this is important. 21 841b1c discusses the distribution of a controlled substance. 18 U.S.C. 841a. These are the crimes of distribution of a controlled substance and possession with intent to distribute. 841b1c is the penalty provision. So what this judgment of conviction does, this conspiracy conviction links in the controlled substances violation. We don't have to look at the plea agreement. We don't have to look at the indictment. We can just look at the statutory elements of 21-84-B1C to see if it relates to controlled substances. By its very terms, the Granero-Rico conviction incorporates the illegal drug activity.
That's what's alleged in count two, which is incorporated into the first element of the offense to which you pled.
Correct. What counsel is requesting that this court do is that this court only look at the statutory elements of conviction. And I'm saying we can do that with 21-84-B1C. We can save an analysis of the camps and Castleman for another day. We don't have to go into whether the statute is divisible, whether we can apply the modified categorical approach. We don't have to look at whether we can look at the plea agreement or the indictment.
Well, just so that we're on the same page, when I was referencing the plea agreement
right.
and the elements to which he entered a plea and the facts that support those elements, the statutory sections that support that element, count two, element one, is specifically alleged in the indictment as and multiple acts involving the distribution of controlled substances, including cocaine, cocaine base in the form of crack cocaine, and marijuana in violation of the laws of the United States, Title 21, United States Code, Sections 841 and 846. That's what you're referencing.
Right, and I'm saying we don't even need to look at the indictment. We don't even need to look at count two that references this because we have the judgment of conviction. It has the statutory elements that counsel wants us only to look at. And we have the Moline case is right on point. We don't have to go into an analysis, to quote counsel, that the doctrinally complex analysis of the camps and Castleman. This statute, 21-841-B1C, distribution of controlled substances, possession with intent to distribute. This clearly relates to controlled substances. So I don't think we need to go into modified categorical approach, because we can see just by looking at the statutory elements that his conviction, his conspiracy conviction, relates to controlled substances.
Well, then are you agreeing with the defendant that the test is the elements of the prior conviction?
I'm saying that under the Wisconsin statute, where it says it can be a sentence enhancer if it relates to controlled substances.
I understand that, and it sounds to me like you're saying relates to means elements. I mean, that's
no, I'm saying that relates to controlled substances. And I don't think elements... You can look at the statutory elements of 841B1C and see that that relates to controlled substances under the Wisconsin statute.
Well, then how do we know 21 U.S.C. 841 B1C deals with drugs? Now, the judgment of conviction, this is Milwaukee County, where is the drug judgment of conviction federally?
It's in Appendix 165, Appellant's Appendix, page 165.
Well, Appendix 165,
Your Honor.
Okay, 155 is the plea agreement. Okay. So it's 841 B1C. Right?
Correct.
And you say that is a drug statute?
It is, correct.
It's just that it's Title 21, not 18.
Right, I'm sorry. Yes, it's a scrivener's error. It's not 18, it's 21. And I think, therefore, this court's analysis can just be, all you have to do is look at Moline, and you can look at the plain language of the Wisconsin statute, whose constitutionality is not challenged by counsel. Does the conspiracy conviction and does the 21841B1C, does it relate to controlled substances? You can look at the statutory elements and see whether it relates to controlled substances. And the state's position is that under Moline and Robertson, all they did was look at the statutory elements, whether drug paraphernalia related to drugs. All they did was look at the drug paraphernalia statute. Yes, drug paraphernalia statute relates to controlled substances. In this case, 841, 21 U.S.C. 841, distribution of controlled substances, possession with intent to distribute controlled substances, certainly relates to controlled substances, to controlled substances.
So you would not have us get involved in the analysis that the Court of Appeals used?
I would not.
Yeah, I think, you know, what I see as I try to think about it in light of other statutes from other states, not just federal statutes, is we would have to know perhaps more about the operation of other states' criminal codes and the United States government's criminal codes than we generally get into when we interpret a Wisconsin statute, unless the legislature has shown us they want us to be tied to a federal statute or use the federal statute as a guide. So you just follow Moline, which is straight statutory.
I would just follow Moline. I think save the bonafide categorical approach for when it would apply, when you would actually need to go into the plea agreement to determine what the elements were of the crime. But in this case, the elements clearly relate to controlled substances.
Counsel, I don't see in the defendant's brief, and I don't see in your brief, any reference to Title 21, 841. Isn't this kind of a surprise?
It is. I was at the hotel Sunday night, and I was trying to find 18 U.S.C. 841. I called a colleague. I said, I can't find this statute. Can you find it? He says, no. I went to work Monday morning. I couldn't find 18 841. So then I searched, you know, I looked at the Westlaw, and then I looked then at the count two and figured out, well, it's 21. And then that made sense because that was referenced in what he pled to in his conspiracy conviction.
Yeah, so it's 21
yep.
U.S.C. 847 and 846 that's involved in the plea agreement.
Yes, that's correct.
841. 841 B1C or something else?
No, 841 B1C. I'm sorry.
So the Justice Robinsack referred to 846. With
this comes out of the plea agreement. It just says Title 21 U.S. Code, Sections 841 and 846.
Yes.
It's not any more particularized in that paragraph.
I know, but I thought we weren't referring to the plea agreement, that we could refer solely to the conviction. Conviction only says 841B1C. Does it refer to 6?
And that it does not refer to 6, but what Justice Robinsack was saying, that in the plea, it also refers to 846.
Right.
But my whole argument is we need to go there.
You're relying on 841.
Yeah.
Okay. Just want to check.
Counsel, I for one am very happy that you found this information, but I'm not quite sure how the court should respond to the fact that
I understand.
You found this information.
And in my defense, I had a moot court with five attorneys. We never caught it. The Court of Appeals never caught it. He never brought it to the court's attention. The district court never brought it. I just found it on Sunday night. I conversed with some other colleagues and said, I need to bring this to the court's attention. And
it's not a surprise. It's in the indictment. It's in the plea agreement. It's what he pled guilty to. It's in the judgment of conviction. The only thing missing is 21. It's not going to be 18 U.S.C. 841. Not as a RICO conviction.
Right.
So I don't know what else it could be. I don't find it particularly surprising, but maybe that's because I was a federal prosecutor.
Well, the cite in the Court of Appeals opinion doesn't have the 21 at all. I mean,
right.
It's just not there as part of the analysis.
Right.
Well, one of the things we have to do is, since this is a new theory that's been unexplored previously, and that is not a criticism. I applaud you for rethinking the case. I applaud you for calling the court's attention, when I say case, statute, and I applaud you for calling it to our attention. But the question, and we'll soon hear, is whether the defendant needs time to make that analysis. Mainly, is this a conviction of 21 U.S.C. 841, which is a controlled substance. It's unlawful to knowingly or intentionally manufacture, distribute, or dispense, or possess with intent to manufacture a controlled substance, or create, etc., with intent to dispense a counterfeit substance. So the question is what he was convicted of, and the conviction has a wrong statutory reference.
That's why I asked him the questions when counsel was up there, and he answered them, I thought.
Yeah, I thought he did, too.
Are there any more questions for me?
Well, perhaps.
could you say again, what did he answer?
When I asked him what he pled guilty to, and I cited to the count two,
right,
which was the count that she's talking about, and he said, yes, he pled guilty to count two. His answer wasn't, you know, it came as a surprise to me. his answer was that, yes, he pled to count two, but conspiracy could mean he did any of those things. Not necessarily that he specifically engaged in a drug offense, but that's why I asked about the 841 information. And he answered it, I thought, to the best of his ability. Anyway.
Oh, okay.
You and I can talk about this later. This is her turn now, right?
I need a little guidance here.
Okay.
It seems to me that opposing counsel would say that the court should not be looking at the plea colloquy to determine whether 21.841B1C was ever discussed or admitted to.
That's correct.
But we should not do that.
I'm
so
saying
that. How do we know that the court just didn't add that?
What do you mean?
Yeah, how do you didn't just add that?
Well, it's certainly in the count two, I believe.
Yeah.
But how do we know that that was ever discussed in any way or pled to in any way? I mean, basically, it seems to me the court is confronted, if we accept everything you say, of whether this case was improvidently granted. I'm not sure that all of this high-level thinking and analysis should go to waste.
I think that it would not go to waste if it was just 1962 D.C., if we just had that statute on his judgment of conviction. then I think we would have to go into DeCamp and Castleman in a modified categorical approach. And then you would have to look at the plea agreement and the indictment where he pled to conspiracy, which included he conspired to, you know, distribute controlled substance under this under Chapter 21. But because the judgment of conviction lists 21 U.S.C. 841, and his whole argument is go to the statutory elements of the judgment of conviction. Several times in his brief, several times today, just the elements in the judgment of conviction. That's what we have here in the judgment of conviction is the statute, Scrivener's error, but 21 U.S.C. 841-BC. And it relates to controlled substances, which the...
What count was dismissed?
Four
what
counts.
Count was
several
dismissed.
Counts dismissed?
Pardon me?
There were, I think there were four counts of Romero that were dismissed.
It says the government agrees to dismiss the remaining counts at the time of sentencing. And the only one that I understand remains is on App 149, which is the conspiracy to commit RICO. So I want to know whether the count that is defined in the, that is referred to in the judgment of conviction was dismissed.
Counts 20, 24, 25, and 26, it says in the judgment of conviction, were dismissed.
Right.
Yes, only he only pled to count two.
Yes, but isn't that the only the RICO charge, not the 21 U.S.C. 841? That's what I'm asking you.
Part of the RICO, the 21.
My response to that is by including the 21 U.S.C. 841, they are linking the controlled substances part of his RICO conspiracy conviction.
Can you could be convicted of the RICO without being convicted of 841?
Sure.
Yeah. Can you be convicted of 21 U.S.C. without being convicted of 841?
Sure.
I should have said it. You can be, these are separate, independent.
Yeah.
Right. So I want to know where in the plea agreement, for example, is there a plea to 21 U.S.C. Section 841? The only thing I can see here, which doesn't mean I'm correct, is he pled to RICO.
Yes.
I want to know where he pled. And we're in the plea agreement. It says he's pleading to the drug one.
It's in paragraph 17
yes.
of the attachment A, and it is the last line of paragraph 17, attachment A.
What page is that, please?
161. It's on 151 and 161. That is the grand jury further charges.
I have it page 139 or page 163 in my
okay, I'll look at 163. I'm happy to look at it all. All right. And what does that tell us?
That's detailing his what he pled to, his RICO conspiracy charge.
Right.
And it goes through, this is what's going through the predicate acts of racketeering activity and what that activity was.
Right.
In the last few sentences of number 17, which include multiple acts involving the distribution of controlled substances, including cocaine, cocaine base in the form of crack cocaine, and marijuana in violation of the laws of the United States, including 21 United States Code, sections 841 and 846.
Yeah, no. That's good, but that's just listing that it's a underlying one of the, I've forgotten how many he said, 40 crimes that underlie the racketeering. As I understand the defendant, he says that's not good enough because it's just one of them. It's not an element. Now, I'm not sure I accept that, but I don't find in whatever pages you say. Now, let me look at 139. Is that the one you want me to look at? And that, too, refers to Title 21, 841. And that, too, is part of the underlying comments. I don't know that these are part of a plea agreement. That's what I'm missing. That on 139, it's the indictment, right? And on 165, which is the other one you suggested.
163, Your Honor.
63. It's attachment A to count 2, right?
Right. Yes.
All right. Is it attached to the plea agreement?
Yep.
All right. And so the fact that this is one of the underlying issues in the racketeering, you say, is good enough to fit the elements.
What I'm saying is we don't even have to look at this. I'm saying all we have to do is we don't have to look at the plea agreement. We don't have to look at the indictment. All we have to do is look at the judgment of conviction.
Right. The judgment of conviction has an error in a reference
That's
to
correct.
A section. And then the question becomes, to me, suppose the judgment of conviction is wrong. Right? He never pled to this. There's no finding of guilt on the second one. We agreed you can be guilty of one but not the other. You don't have to be guilty of both, right?
Right.
So where in the documents show that he pled guilty or part of the plea agreement was 21 U.S.C. 841?
I think the judgment of conviction, what it's...
We don't look behind it. That's what you're saying, right?
I'm sorry, what?
Do not look behind the judgment
of conviction. No, I wasn't going there. I was going to say the judgment of conviction, why it's listing 21 U.S.C. is that it's incorporating the controlled substances. So you know exactly what Garnero, you know, what his conspiracy involved. It involved the controlled substances.
See, under this judgment of conviction, is he guilty of two offenses or one?
Just one.
Okay. So you're saying if the judgment of conviction on the racketeering has a reference to a particular statute?
Yes, it does.
If it does, then you can look at it. So does it have to? Did it have to have a reference to 21 U.S.C. 841?
It did not.
It did not. Okay. But if it does, then you look at it and you say, okay, he's guilty of drugs. If it didn't have this reference, then what do you say then?
Then I say we go to DeCamps and Castleman.
Right. Okay. That's what I'm interested in what your position on that is.
Yep.
And there's nothing underlying his conviction of 841.
Just the
as a separate offense.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you confident that you would win even if you hadn't found this mistake?
I was hoping.
Well, it certainly was a more complicated.
It was a good moment on Sunday night. I'll put it that way. So, and it will. I mean, I just don't think the court needs to look at that modified categorical approach because I agree with counsel because the judgment of conviction. We just need to look at the statutory elements.
In this case.
And with that, this is another question. The state requests that the court affirm the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
But on different grounds than the Court of Appeals
yes.
decided the case.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. What are you going to say to them, Zapples?
What I have to say to that, Your Honor, is that the one thing that opposing counsel and I agree on is that that judgment of conviction contains a Scribner's error. If we look at the count, and again, this is appendix page 165, the statutory reference, 841B1C, is a relation to count 25, which was dismissed. That's the only controlled substance crime that was charged against Guarnero, but that was dismissed. So there is not a conviction on the record of controlled substances. That's the reference, and in fact, if we look at, and I believe it is...
Except
Except he was convicted of count two, and count two specifically references that code section.
But it's not an element. And again, the state has apparently conceded and agreed with our position, which is the correct analysis is the element.
I think she said in this case you don't have to go further because the element is present, so why argue about it? But I don't think she agrees with you that's a correct analysis.
And to be fair, in this case, that element is absolutely not present because Guarnero was absolutely not convicted of 22 U.S.C. 841 B1C. That offense was charged in count 25, and count 25 was dismissed. The only count that he was convicted of was count two of the indictment, and that stated.
It was paragraph 17, attachment A to his plea, in the last sentence, which talks about title 21 U.S. Code section 841. What do you do with that if you're telling me he didn't plead to it?
Because he did not plead to a commission of those offenses. Those are predicate offenses.
I get that, but all we're trying to do is see if there's a connection with, okay? And he's pleading multiple acts involving, and then he goes on to plead to that there were multiple acts that involved, and the involvement was drugs.
What Guarnero pleaded guilty to was conspiring to conduct the affairs of an organization through a pattern. And the pattern is alleged to include many of those offenses, including the reference to 841B1C, as well as homicide and arson and kidnapping and a lot of other things. But again, going back to, and we respectfully suggest that we do have to go into the analysis under DeCamps insofar as the Apprendi part of it is concerned, because this is exactly the sort of post hoc parsing of prior records that is the problem, not just under Apprendi, but also under Moncrief versus Holder, which we also cite in our briefs. This is part of the problem with the state's approach. But just to be perfectly clear, because I think this is obviously something that the state has never before argued until today, the reference in the judgment of conviction, we both agree, the state and I both agree, that this judgment of conviction contains a Scribner's error.
But, you know, you don't agree on this. Her error is that it's not in 18 U.S.C. That's her error. As I understand you, counsel, your error is that there should have been no reference to 841B1C, 21, 31, 101.
That's exactly
it's
correct.
Out. So here's my question to you. If you went back to the United States District Court, Eastern District of Wisconsin, and said there is an error in this conviction, this judgment of conviction, because it says the defendant is adjudicated guilty of these offenses. That's the first line there. And lists 8041B1C, you would say, Judge Randa, he wasn't adjudicated guilty of 841B1C at all, because that is a separate, distinct offense. And the state agrees with you on that. So you went back and said, no error. It was only one conviction, 1962D conspiracy. What would Randa say?
Well, it's hard.
What should he say?
He should say that that's exactly right, because, again, when a person pleads guilty, and again, this is under DeCamps, this is under Apprendi, when a person pleads guilty to an offense, and the offense charged in count two is conspiracy, racketeering conspiracy under section 1962D, it does not charge that Guarnero committed an offense under 21841. So the correct analysis is that he was not convicted, and he was not convicted. There's nothing in the plea, what the plea agreement discusses are facts, extraneous facts. I see my time has expired.
May we finish your answer?
What we see in count two of the indictment are allegations that he and other co-defendants may have committed various predicate acts. One of those predicate acts may have been 841B1C, or alternatively, maybe another defendant committed the violation of 841B1C. We don't know. What we do know, Your Honors, is that what Guarnero was convicted of was not possession or distribution of controlled substances. That count was dismissed. And again, we can't emphasize that enough. That count was dismissed. That was count 25. And if we look at the record, the appendix, count 25 is on appendix page 142.
142. All right.
And what that count says is that is where we find the reference to 21 U.S.C. 841 A1 B1D in count 25, not in count 2. Count 25 was dismissed. There's no finding of guilt with respect to 21 U.S.C. 841. So include
841 B1D and A1. Right. Okay.
It's in a dismissed count, and so it would be inappropriate, and in fact, we would argue unconstitutional for this court or the Court of Appeals or any court to use that as a basis to find a connection to controlled substances, because there is no conviction. To the extent that this judgment of conviction makes reference to that statute, at very most, that is an error in the judgment of conviction, because further on, again, in the next line down from that line, says counts 20, 24, 25, and 26 are dismissed on the motion of the United States.
Great.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Thank, on behalf of the court, Attorney Eddington and Attorney Larson for their arguments in what has turned out to be a surprise ending, or at least a surprise interim relating to whether or not there was a conviction that was referenced in the federal court. That ends 2013 AP 1753-1754 CR State versus Guarnero. The court is adjourned for oral argument this month unless we get another case, and it is now 2:45. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:15. We are adjourned.